Well, hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm your host, Ray Graff. We're discussing birds today with none other than Rich Guthrie, who is here to help your questions, help answer your questions, although he could probably help ask your questions as well. Rich is a veteran birder, a former NCON specialist, and compiler of the Catskill, New York Christmas bird count for the National Audubon Society back in the day. Rich is our resident avian expert. He is here. He is our high-flying guest today, although he looks pretty sober, actually, today. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You all right, Rich? You okay?
We're getting started.
Off to a flying start.
Yeah, right.
All right, so you can call the number, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org, or tweet us, sure, at WAMC Vox Pop. But once again, the number to call is 800-348-2551. Rich, I got to tell you, I was outside just now in front of the station getting a breath of fresh air.
A beautiful day.
I think I saw a bird. Oh. I think I saw a bird.
Well, you're right on then.
Yeah, I mean,
we're in Albany, New York.
Pretty sure it was a bird.
Sounds to me like probably the pigeon that I saw fly by as I was coming in.
This was a little fella.
A little fella.
He had wings and what appeared to be a beak.
Oh, that fits the bill.
Okay, fits the bill. Very good. Yeah. So, actually, there were about four or five in the tree, and they were small. They were not crows. They were not pigeons. They were little guys.
Were they black or brown?
Dark. Yeah.
It could have been either. My guess, being that we're in the urban environment right now, there are four basic birds. You name two of them, and the other two would be the sparrow and the starling.
Okay.
And with those four, you pretty well have most of the inner city birds nailed.
Yeah. Well, they're out, and they're frolicking and having fun today.
And not bad. It's a beautiful day for that. Now, both the starling and the house sparrow, technically, are... And the pigeon are non-native species. They were imported either as pets or as props or as baggage, stowaways.
Mm.
And they ended up over here, done quite well in this country. They're very successful as a bird.
I got to tell you, I'm a little surprised. This early in the program, the lines are loaded.
Yes.
And if you at home are desirous of a discussion with Rich, when you hear somebody hang up, that's the time to call, 800-348-2551. If, in fact, you have also seen a bird, as I have, it was very exciting. Let's go to Michael in Saratoga Springs. Michael.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Welcome back, Rich.
Thank you.
I have I thought it was a unique event. Maybe you can tell me about it, but... We have this little, what my wife calls a mini crab apple tree in the back yard. It's basically little berries, and typically it survives the winter, and then, like, in the spring, we get, like, cedar waxwings and other birds stopping there and eating them on their way back here. But this year, I think it was December 30th, right, the day before New Year's Eve, all of a sudden, I felt like I was in a scene from The Birds. There were robins everywhere in our backyard. We live in downtown Saratoga Springs. There had to be, like, 100 or more robins. And they just kept coming on this tree and stripped it bare of all the berries. So I have a two-part question. Is that kind of late for the robins to be migrating? And secondly, I didn't realize robins migrated in a flock like that.
Well, that's what happens. Yes to both, if yes is an appropriate answer to either.
Okay.
Robins do stay around now for the most of throughout the winter. In fact, some years we have thousands of robins. They do congregate during winter months. They are gregarious through the winter, and then in the spring they'll pair off and become territorial and chase each other around out of their own individual territories. But right now they're very a grouping bird. as far as the crabapples are concerned, you know what's happening with that. Crab apples and other fruits like that, regular apples or sumac and multiflora rose fruits are available through the winter, mainly because early in the season, they're not particularly desired by many of the birds. So they hang on the tree right into the winter, and usually they go untouched until late winter, early spring, after we've had a few freeze-thaw cycles, and then they become, chemically, they become a little changed. If you ever take an apple and leave it out in a cold night and let it freeze and then bring it in and let it thaw or leave it on the dash of your car, as I have done. they have almost like a baked apple type of flavor. They're sweeter, they're soft, they're very easily obtained and digested. And that's what the robins are after with those crabapple trees. And once they find them, I know the neighbor trees in my area have been stripped bare just within the last week or so. And it's all about that warm spell that we had after the hard freeze and a little unusual climate we're experiencing, and that's what's making a change in their style.
Okay, and these guys, will they stay together on their migration?
Sure. They migrate long, loose flocks back to Canada, Manitoba, or Warren County.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to June in Walden, New York. June, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
We have a huge bird feeder. We feed every kind of bird. We've been feeding them for over 30 years, but the last 2 years we've noticed that there has been not any black-capped chickadees. We've seen one in 2 years. And we thought maybe it was the harsh winter last year. This winter, it's pretty mild, and we use finch food for finch. We use regular bird seed with the sunflower seeds, but they seem to have gone.
Well, that's a little unusual that there are not a few around. Chickadees and many other bird species are cyclical, and they go through these population ups and downs, a roller coaster ride. Some years you'll have lots, some years you'll have few, and some years you'll have an influx from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I guess this is their year in your neighborhood to be on the downside of their population cycle. I wouldn't put too much weight into the significance of that. I think that there is, it's probably part of a normal cycle. I, for example, am not witnessing a shortage of black-capped chickadees in the area. They can survive. They can handle even the harshest that winter can throw at them. They do quite well, surprisingly, for a tiny little bird that they are.
Yes.
But they're good.
Thank you. Is there any food that would attract them, or is it just, like you said, just because of the cycle?
I think it's just because of the cycle. If you have black oil sunflower seed out there, you're their best friend for now. And
we have lots of squirrels, so I was thinking maybe the squirrels might chase them away.
Nah.
No?
Nah.
No.
They can handle it.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
Quite
welcome.
I'll
have a look for them next year.
Well, good luck with them, and I hope they'll be back. Don't you worry.
All right. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, June. It's Vox Pop. Ray Graff here. Number to call is 800-348-2551. We're joined by Rich Guthrie. We talk birds every month or so. Now, last month we talked about the coming Christmas bird count. Were you involved at all?
Absolutely.
And how did it go?
It went very, very well.
How many birds did you count?
Lots and lots.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We were fortunate one day in a January. The Christmas bird count extends from the middle of December to the beginning of January.
Yeah.
It used to be Christmas Day, but, you know, the reality set in and said, you're not going to get those people out there on Christmas Day.
So right, you are.
They extended. What it is an early winter census, and that's been going on for more than 100 years. This year, I participated in several, I think it was four different counts, from Catskill, New York, up to Troy, New York, and Albany and Chatham. And fortunately, on the Troy count, we were experiencing a very, very mild winter. And just before the Troy Christmas bird count came around, the weather set in. And all of a sudden, the skies just opened up, and the snow geese from up north that had been lingering far too long decided now.
Now's the time.
Yeah, we'll leave now. Thank you. And they were in the sky by the thousands and thousands and thousands. And what a beautiful sight.
You don't count those, though, right?
Absolutely.
Well, they're flying through.
Three, four. They're there.
Yeah, but
they're there.
They won't be there very long.
Well, they won't someplace else. Here they are.
Yeah, well, I guess
so.
You're right.
You know, if they were down in Chesapeake, they'd count them down there, and we wouldn't.
Yeah.
But no, we know where they are, and that, you know, that puts a pin on a dot on a map, and says, well, there's where the snow geese are today.
Yeah.
And somebody in Chesapeake saying, well, where all the snow geese are? Well, they're still up in Troy, New York.
Was there any counting done on Christmas Eve, which was 72 degrees here in Albany?
Probably.
I wonder if you see anything, any strange birds on that particular day.
Well, you know what happens is a lot of our birds, many of our different bird species, will have a few lingering late leavers.
Yeah.
That stick around for one reason or another. or that go in the wrong direction, that instead of going south, they went east. And so end up, the western bird ends up on the east coast.
How did that happen? Don't they have a great sense of direction magnetically or
millions
some?
Millions and millions of them do.
Really?
A few don't. And there's the few that end up in a different place. And those are the ones that may probably, in all likelihood, it's a one-way trip for them. You know, it's kind of sad, but they ain't going far.
Yeah.
You know, they just don't have it in them.
So they hit Buffalo and they're done.
They hit Buffalo. They hit Long Island or Cape Cod.
Yeah.
And some of them do manage to make it. And those survivors are the ones that may set the trend for the next generation to be on. Those how the colonists, the settlers bring a population to a remote area.
Yeah, very interesting.
It happens. You know, some of our northern finches, for example, can be found in Central America. The high mountains of Central America or in Española or in Europe. And we have representative species that have spun off from the American or European ancestry and have established a population in a new world.
That's very interesting.
This is how that happens. So, and this winter being so mild, a lot of these little lost fellas and gals ended up in a strange place, but were able to survive. The early onset of winter didn't take their toll.
Very interesting. Rich Guthrie is our guest. Now, is there a place we can see the results of this year's bird count?
Absolutely. ebird.org.
ebird.org. Rich Guthrie is our guest. We'll take a break, and then back to the calls we'll go. 800-348-2551.
Support comes from Haydenville Woodworking and Design, a group of artisans designing and building renovations, additions, new homes, custom cabinets, and furniture for over 30 years. HaydenvilleWD.com for virtual portfolio. Union College Concert Series, presenting the Modigliani String Quartet. The French Ensemble offers a program featuring Dvorak's American Quartet, Sunday, February 21st, 3 p.m. UnionCollegeConcerts.org. The Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York, open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, and Sunday, 12 to 5. HydeCollection.org. And Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551, the number. Also, you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Rich Guthrie is our guest. And, Rich, this one came in via email from Nancy in Wilton, who writes, "I am seeing what I believe are bluebirds near a home that has extensive feeding stations. First question is, do they overwinter in Saratoga County?"
Yes.
Okay. Here's the second part of Nancy's question. Also, Nancy writes, "I see another bird with a buff white breast, slate gray blue back and wings, medium-sized perching, no crown, pointed long bill, and I can't identify it. It shows up in early spring in pairs, mid-season, and then in late fall.
Yikes.
Any suggestions?" Would you like the description again?
Let's go through that again and
see
what we can.
A buff white breast.
A buff white, yes.
Slate gray blue back and wings.
Okay.
Medium-sized perching, no crown.
No crown, no.
Pointed long bill.
Yep.
And it's a mystery to Nancy and Wilton.
I think Nancy is probably looking at another bluebird.
Really?
Yeah, in bad light. You know, the blue on a bluebird is not really blue. It's actually kind of a brownish color, depending on the angle of the light. And against a backlighting, it will actually look black or gray.
Oh, interesting.
So, and it does, the female especially will have that buff on the breast, no crown, and be that coloration. So
okay.
I think that's what it is. And bluebirds do overwinter. They like the robins. They're related to the robins, and they eat berries and things like that.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. And Carrie in Plainfield, Mass. Carrie, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Rich. Hi. Hey, I'm not trying to be a wise guy, and maybe this question should be on a science forum.
Fine.
But if you released a flying squirrel, let's say from the observation of the Empire State Building, would it survive its landing? In other words,
yes.
What's the glide rate on a squirrel?
You know, flying squirrels, one of my favorite little creatures out there that so few folks, and myself included, either don't see or don't see enough of. They're strictly nocturnal.
Right.
They're very, very stealthful. They're very quiet. And they move around in mysterious ways after dark. And they're the cutest little things. They have big eyes, koala-like features to it, and koala, you know, the teddy bear-like features, little rounded ears, and this soft, soft, flat tail. And, of course, the web between the on the folds of the skin that enable them to glide. You know, like, you know who's taking off on these things are these people that you see with the flying suits?
Sure. Yeah.
And that's what a flying squirrel looks like, except that the squirrels have it a little better. They have a tail that they can use as a rudder and also as a brake, you know, to soften the landing. They
sure.
just set it down. And yeah, so if you set one of these things loose at a high altitude, they'll just keep going and going, spiraling down, and they'll come down with a nice soft landing in the end. But they don't usually. They climb up a tree, glide across, come down at the bottom of the next tree, yeah. go up again, and they work at night.
Yeah,
and
I did see them one time in my life. I was very fortunate. A whole nest of them flew out of a tree one night.
That will happen. And woodcutters will sometimes find them in a hollow of a tree, which is where they spend the day.
Yeah.
But so few people do see them.
I grew up around here, and I've never seen one.
They are here. That's the thing. They're like the screech owl. You know, the screech owl is a fairly common little predator, and they can be found in all sorts of environments, from city parks to hedgerows to cemeteries to the suburban yard. And yet they're out there and very seldom observed.
Kerry, I got to say, you're a regular caller on this program, and you've outdone yourself today with the question of dropping flying squirrels off the Empire State Building.
I know it wasn't a bird question. It's a mammal question. That's why I said possibly the science.
Well, we can handle that one.
Genius, man. Genius.
He's a sharp. Anything to do with flying, I guess he knows the answer.
Hey, thanks a lot for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. 1-800-348-2551. Over to Colleen in Ellenville. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because this morning on my walk through the woods, I came upon a dead woodpecker.
Oh.
And something had attacked it, and all that was left were just all the beautiful feathers and the head and the bill.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, I mean, I know I have a hawk nesting, a red-tailed hawk that nests in the woods next to my house.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also seen a bald eagle this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, would they be predatory towards a bird like that? Or
not likely, especially not the eagle. And a red-tailed hawk is a big, bulky bird that sort of clumps around in the woodlands and the edge of the woods. And their main food is mice and small mammals like that. More than likely, what did the thing to the woodpecker, which is one of the other types of hawks, the sharp-shinned or Cooper's hawk, regularly feed on small birds, and they're quite agile when it comes to flying through the woods. They have short, rounded wings and a long tail. The wings enable them to fit through the branches and the twiggery of the woods, and the long tail gives them that rudder to make sharp right turns, and their element of approaches by surprise and speed. So and they will regularly, you know, unfortunately, but this is the way it is. Probably what took it out. So.
Okay. So it's part of nature's rich pageant.
Yes. I just felt bad, and then I was looking. There were no paw prints. I thought coyote. There was nothing around, and I thought, well, then it's got to be another bird.
It probably was. And then at night, the owls will come out. So, you know, it's a jungle out there.
It is a jungle out there. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Colleen, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. Over to Bill in Albany. Bill, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
Ray, I've been listening to WAMC all day, and this is the only program that's for the birds. I have a two-part question. Okay, obviously during the spring, summer, early fall, I don't have a problem attracting birds to my feeder. I live in the middle of the city of Albany, so and we have like house sparrows and doves and blue jays and cardinals, and I feed them black oil sunflower seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time of the year, you know, every day I have to go out and refill the bird feeder. But during the winter, aside from migration, I don't believe many of the birds that feed at my feeder migrate. There are fewer and fewer birds this winter.
Well,
and secondly,
yeah,
the other day it rained, and then that night it got cold, so some of my black oil sunflower seeds froze. I brought the feeder into the house. The seeds thawed, and I put the feeder back out. Will the birds still feed off the feeder or bird feeder or not, because it was frozen at one time?
No, that should not be a problem. And I'm sure it happens quite often out there in the wild anyway. So as long as it doesn't get moldy or something like that, which, if you know, quick turnaround, that won't happen. And as far as the number of birds at your feeder, I'm really surprised. But, you know, it has been so far a mild winter, and a lot of other bird feeder people are experiencing the same thing, never mind regardless of whether they're in the city or in the country.
Yeah.
You know, feeder activity has been a little low this year, but wait till the next snowstorm comes, and I think you'll see it perk up a little bit. In fact,
one other suggestion, Ray, that last segment with the music, the jazz sax,
yeah,
was that from Bootland in New York City?
I'm sorry, say it again?
Was that jazz segment live from the Birdland Jazz Club in New York City?
No, but you were close. That was actually Charlie the Bird Parker, and that
yes,
was live in Washington, D.C. in about 1953 or so.
You guys are all right.
Cool.
Yeah, thanks, Bill, for
Take
the call.
Care, gentlemen.
Appreciate
right.
it.
Bye now.
800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie is our guest, and Rich, this one came in via email at voxpop@wamc.org. Simple question from Don, who says, why do bald and golden eagles have a different genus?
Because they are not that closely related. The bald eagle, Haliaetus, is a member of the eagle part is only something that we pegged onto them. You know, like buzzard and hawk and chicken,
yeah,
and all that. So that's an artificial appellation. But what it is the bald eagle is related to the sea eagle, the Stella sea eagle, the white-tailed sea eagle, the African fish eagle, and the like. So they, you know, they're like pigeons and doves, or a little further removed, geese and ducks. Same family,
yeah,
different genus.
Okay.
And the golden eagle is more related to the red-tailed hawk than it is to the sea eagle. So they are structurally different. Their behavior is different. Their food style is different. And so they are quite different.
So putting these together is largely an artificial construct.
It is, but it's a category. It's a pigeonholing, so to speak.
Well, that's very
and,
good.
And Linnaeus set up the rules, and folks try to follow them.
All right, let's go to Richard in Lake Katrine. Richard, you're on.
Hi, Ray and Rich. Glad to talk to you today. I'm sitting here about 5 feet away from the birds feeding at my bird feeder.
Oh, nice.
And that brings up a question that I have about the pileated woodpecker, which is also a frequent visitor to these feeders. I actually attached a suet feeder right to the window and put a nice sturdy perch on it so he'd have a good place to land. And he's a frequent visitor at this particular bird feeder. Like I say, I'm sitting about 5 feet away from where the birds actually are looking out the window. And if you're very still, you know, if you move around, you can scare him away. But if you're very still, he'll come and feed for 3-4 minutes at a time and then fly away. And he comes several times a day. How common is that for the pileated, who has kind of a reputation as a shy bird?
And you're right, it is. And it is not common at all. In fact, I'm quite surprised that that bird is so tolerant. But what happens is birds watch other birds. They learn, they look for secrets of survival. And they pick up on the cues and the tricks and what works and what doesn't work with while watching other birds of their own kind or other kinds. So this is why you'll have a bird, let's say a warbler or a kinglet or the like, show up at a bird feeder and saying, wow, looks good here. But then it looks around and doesn't find what they're looking for. It's not their style, not their diet. And so they move on. Or they might find something of their liking and learn to cope with it. And the pileated woodpecker, or pileated, depends on where you're all from, is one of those. And most of the time, they just kind of, they are, as you described, they are shy. But every now and then, you'll get one that is willing to take the risk, see that it works, and learns to come back. So, that's the first of I've heard of one coming that close. They will, on rare occasions, come to suet. Does happen. But that close to a house, man, that's remarkable. You must get some great photos.
Richard, thank you for the call. You know, that's an interesting point. You say that birds watch other birds and they learn, bearing in mind how difficult and inexact it is to measure IQ across the animal spectrum. What's the smartest bird?
Actually, they're all pretty smart. I think it's, you know, it's like the eye of the eagle. They all have great eyes, incredible acumen, and intelligence. It's that also is shared throughout the bird realm. And
so is there a way that, in other words, it strikes me as being fairly smart if you're watching another bird doing something and you're saying, well, you know, I'm going to try that.
Some birds will are intuitively imitative and will imitate things that please us. And we give them positive reinforcement. They learn that that works very well, and so they will repeat that behavior, like the parrots or the minor birds, some of the other tame birds. So what they do is they and this can happen with wild birds. I have, for example, normally shy bird is the American crow. They learned over the years to be very wary of people because they've been shot at so many times.
Yeah.
They say, don't go there. But I have them when they see me, they will come to me now because I have been rewarding them. And I have a group of crows that as soon as I step outside the house.
So it's operant conditioning. It's not intelligence.
It is. They are smart. And some are smart. And I have to assume that there is some level of learning skills out there. But they all have to be on the game.
So you say crows have learned to be skittish around people because they've been shot. You're not suggesting that intelligence or wisdom and knowledge can be transmitted down the generations.
No, but they learn from their parentage. In other words, when they're out there getting their wings, earning their wings, they're also taking cues from what works and what doesn't work. For example, let me give you an example. Here in America, we do bird watches in order to entice birds to come in from hiding in the shrubbery. We'll do an imitation of an alarm call of a wren or a titmouse, and it sounds something like psh, 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 psh. And other birds, like the chickadee or the sparrow or the nuthatch or the woodpecker, will come to you when you're doing that sound.
Huh.
Strange sound that it is, but they have learned it through the system, the grapevine, that sound says there's a problem. It's either a cat or a fox or a hawk, and they will come to investigate so they can know what the problem is so they can take appropriate action. But if you go over to Europe and try that, go around England and go like, psh, 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 where they don't have the titmouse or the Carolina wren making that sound, the birds over there say, keep on going.
Who's this nitwit?
What's that?
Right.
And the British bird is, of course, look around and say, there's another Yank trying his silly stuff.
All right. Rich Guthrie is our guest. Let's go to Carol in Valencia. Carol, you're on.
Hi. It's always wonderful to hear Ray and Rich. I really love the show when
Thank you.
On. And I have a window bird feeder, and I've been getting a lot of birds this year. But I've noticed with the goldfinch that several of them have problems with their eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Their eyes are almost closed
over. Oh, yeah.
And
okay.
I was wondering what it is, and is there anything, I mean, do the birds die from it, or do they recover from whatever it is?
What it is ain't good. It's a highly infectious disease called conjunctivitis that encrusts the eyelids, causing the causes the eyes, the eyelids actually shut. I mean, and the birds become visually impaired that way. And they become easy prey to predators and the like. What you need to do is stop feeding them right now and take the feeder in and give it a good cleaning. And then hold off on the feeding for a while until you know what's going to happen. Those ones with the incrustation will probably not recover, and what you need to do is prevent it from spreading to other ones that might be coming to the feeder. They come in; it comes from direct contact with an infected bird or a contaminated area, and the bird feeder itself is probably a vector of that contamination. So
I haven't noticed it with any of the other birds. I mean,
no,
I have nuthatches, chickadees.
You're right. And what it is it's
purple finches. I've seen all of these other birds at the feeder as well, but nothing.
Yes,
like the goldfinch.
Right, and it is selective. And goldfinches seem to be susceptible to this. They have a failed immunity to this. The other birds seem to be able to to avoid it. So I would still take the feeder and give it a good cleaning with Clorox or, you know, bleach. And wait a while before putting it back out again. And then good luck with that. This is why, well, no fault of yours. This conjunctivitis has been around in nature, but it has an opportunity to expand into a population when feeding stations are made available and more birds will come to the same spot that an infected bird may have been.
Of course, they could be at my bird feeder, but they could be at another bird feeder, too.
Yes. You're absolutely right.
I will try to limit what I can do to
exactly.
the spread, but
yes.
How successful I am depends on other neighbors who have bird feeders.
Well, I would suggest that it's probably very local to your neighborhood because it's not that widespread out there.
Okay.
And I would take every effort to. And these birds, once they're infected, will not travel far. They just don't have the ability to move far. So they're going to be local to your area.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Now, in humans, conjunctivitis, it'll go away, won't it?
Yes, we have treatment mechanisms, but the birds can be treated, but they have to be caught, and that's very, very difficult to do, and you need to have a license to do it. You need to be a licensed rehabilitator and a trained avian veterinarian to be able to licensed rehabilitator. It can be done. But the thing is, can you catch them all? Do you want to be drawing them back in while others may become infected and getting away?
That's a good point. All right, we'll take a break here. Rich Guthrie is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back.
Comes from Unusual Wedding Rings and More in Crawford Square, North Street, downtown Pittsfield. A jewelry emporium providing traditional and non-traditional engagement, wedding, and anniversary rings for conventional and same-sex couples. UnusualWeddingRings.com. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to protect ecologically important lands and waters of the Adirondacks for nature and people. nature.org/Adirondacks. HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting Cat on a Hot Tin Roof by Tennessee Williams, weekends February 12th through the 28th at the Spa Little Theater, Saratoga Spa State Park. HomemadeTheater.org. And Windy Hollow Veterinary Clinic, Montague, Massachusetts. Conventional and integrative veterinary medicine, including acupuncture and chiropractic therapy. Comprehensive pet care and health services since 1998. WindyHollowVet.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the number. Ray Graff here, Rich Guthrie, our guest, as we talk birds, and a lot of calls to get to, Rich, but you wanted to talk briefly about Cuba.
Yes.
You were in Cuba.
No, we will be going to Cuba in March.
Oh, really?
This year,
oh,
yes.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, and there's still room. If somebody wants to join us, a group out of Boston University, we're going down there, and we're going in March.
How do you find out about it?
Call me. Contact me. RichardPGuthrie@gmail.com.
RichardPGuthrie@gmail.com. Fair enough.
Yes. Join us.
This one came in via email, and then back to the phones we go. This is from Chris. A few years ago, there was a family of flying squirrels living in the woods around my house. I began putting peanuts on the branches of a small maple by my front door and then giving a loud whistle. The flying squirrels were quick learners, and very soon at least half dozen would be gliding into the maple while I stood there whistling and putting more peanuts on the branches. This went on for a few years, and then they all disappeared. On nights with a full moon, there would be a pair of screech owls calling very close by. The flying squirrels would never come in for peanuts while the screechies were around. It made me remember the Audubon painting of the screech owls with dead flying squirrels in their talons.
There you go. I think you got the story there.
All right, let's go to the phones and Margie in Olive Bridge. Hi, Margie, you're on.
Hey, Ray, how are you?
Good.
Good. Hiya, Rich. So, actually, flying squirrels, I didn't actually call about flying squirrels, but since that came up, I see flying squirrels a lot because they live in our attic.
Cool.
Oh, sometimes
yeah, not
cool.
Too cool.
No?
Yeah.
Well,
no, it's not my attic. It's pretty cool.
Well, my cat thinks it's cool because every now and again he catches one and it breaks my heart.
Oh. Yeah.
Because they are such lovely little guys, but we're trying to get get them out.
Yeah.
But the reason that I called was because a couple of years ago, we, you know, I feed guys a lot, and we've always had a lot of commuters, rose-breasted grosbeaks and indigo buntings coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And the last, well, the last 2 years, I haven't seen any indigo buntings, but always saw rose-breasted grosbeaks, and now I don't see those guys anymore either.
Well, and you're talking spring and summer, correct?
Yes, absolutely. It's a very particular time, right when the red-winged blackbirds come through.
Yes. Yep.
And then shortly after that, I can expect to see the Mrs. Rose-Breasted Grosbeak and then Mr. Rose-Breasted Grosbeak and Mrs. Indigo Bunting.
Well, that's a peculiarity of those two species. And interesting that you picked up on that, is that for some reason, and I don't know if there's a logical explanation, but they do when they're coming north in May, early mm-hmm. May, around the 5th of May.
Yes.
5:30 in the afternoon on the 5th of May. They will stop at feeders and feast and then move on, not to come back again until the next year. Unless, you know, maybe some places will have the rose-breasted grosbeaks come back at the feeder through the summer, and that's quite fun when they bring the babies with them and everybody has a party at your house.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, yeah, that's what happens. They come back in May, feast up, and move on. And now, I would here's something that may be a factor in this,
okay.
is that certain family, extended family groups of certain species will follow the same migration path. This is just conjecture. This is just a little theory here. Follow the same migration path year after year after year after year. You know,
right.
the same footprints. They follow just like the cattle in the field.
Yeah.
And
except that there are no footprints. How do they do that?
It's in their genes. You know, the birds have remarkable navigation systems. And we know this from identifiable individuals. Sight fidelity among birds is quite high. They will come from their wintering area, from their summer area up in northern Canada, and come to the same feeder year after year.
Huh, amazing.
In the winter. And waterfowl and seagull and gulls.
Yeah.
We don't say seagulls. So I do, and I allow people to say seagulls.
Is that an insult?
You know, well, it's not an insult.
Okay.
It's just kind of like a statement that is frowned upon by the big bird community.
Get off your high perch,
exactly.
Guthrie.
Exactly. Not me.
Oh, okay.
I say go for it. That's why it just slipped.
Okay.
But they will come back to the same pier on the beach in the harbor. Year after year. And we know this from identifiable individuals. They might have a particular pattern. You know, birds are highly variable individually, subtle differences between one and the other. And if you can pick out a pattern on one bird, you'll see that it will come back year after year.
I'll be darned.
Well, that's why I was surprised not to see them anymore.
Yeah.
You know, because I watch for them because they, you know, they just bring me so much joy.
I know.
And
I know.
To not see them anymore is really kind of heartbreaking.
Maybe they decided to take the toll road this year.
Maybe something happened to them. If it's the same ones.
It could be. You know, a building goes up someplace down in Maryland along the coast where they migrate. It wasn't there before. And it was in that same pathway that they were using for eons. There goes that strain.
Because we would have several, like I'd say maybe three pairs come through.
Yeah.
Of those gorgeous guys.
Yeah.
And they'd hang around for a couple of weeks, and then, they'd go on their way.
They disappear. They slink back into the woods. So I would not give up on them. Keep the feeders going in May, and I would keep an eye out for them. Perhaps they're choosing a different timetable, and they're there when you're not seeing them.
Oh, that could be. Yeah. All right.
Thanks, Margie.
Oh, thank you. Enjoy the day.
Thank you.
You too. Let's go over to Mark in Sharon, Connecticut. Mark, you're on with Rich Guthrie.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you guys for taking my call. It's my first time calling in.
Nice to have you.
My question is about how the birds eat, the mechanics of it. I noticed that my chickadees and titmice take a seed and fly a few feet away and put it between their feet, and the juncos and everything eat on the ground, and the blue jays just seem to shovel it in their mouth nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
And just what's going on with all these different, what's the...
Different adaptations. Different adaptations. They all have their different mechanisms for getting food and holding on to it and breaking into it. So you know, woodpeckers will drum their head against dead wood, and a hawk will swoop down over a field for a mouse. And the blue jay, being rather aggressive omnivore, will take what he can and move on quickly. And, you know, you'd say the titmice and the chickadees are rather genteel about the whole thing, but when it comes down to it, you know, if it's your back that they as a beetle that they're beating up on, you know that they mean business. So, you know, it's different styles, different forms of adaptation for finding food and avoiding being food.
And is there a reason the chickadees and the nuthatches, they generally don't eat off the ground, they go to the feeder and take it away?
Just their style. They're more arboreal. They're more arboreal, and the sparrows and juncos are ground feeders. They'll scratch their way and they leaf litter, looking to see what's spilled to the ground.
Although, and they eat it right there.
And leave it. And then you know, some of them go both ways. You know, the doves or the pigeons or the goldfinches will feed on the ground and up in the alder.
Okay, and just another note, because someone called about the hawk.
Mm-hmm.
One of my clients, I take care of him, some homing pigeons, and just this week I had a sharpshin hawk get inside the coop.
Ow.
And kill two of them. And then while I was cleaning the coop, it kept flying around.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And I had gone online and looked, and they said something about hanging CDs by the doors because the hawk would see the reflection of themselves.
Ah.
And spook them off. Have you heard anything like that?
I have seen that being used, and I don't know the effectiveness of it. I think it's certainly worth a try.
Yeah.
But a very aggressive hawk. I could not believe that while I was there, it was still trying to.
That's
get
a good use for your Kenny G CDs.
Oh, no.
No, you like Kenny G. All right. Mark, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go over to Jason in Niskayuna. Jason.
Hey, guys. How's it going? I appreciate that I had the opportunity to ask this question.
All right.
I live in Niskayuna. Nearby is a big shopping center with a lot of box stores. And I was there recently, and as I was walking out of the home improvement store, I heard a weird noise, and there was a common raven up on top of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And I really know that to be, at least I'm under the impression that that's more of an elevational species. I tend to see it up in the mountains. I've seen it in Yosemite and up in the mountains of Vermont. And also, I feel like I've seen reports that it's kind of a species in decline. I know in Tennessee, where I'm from, it's actually a state species of concern. So to see it in a parking lot in Schenectady, I wonder the significance of that. Is that really that unusual?
Well, Jason, you're right on there with something. The raven was virtually unknown in New York not too long ago. I remember seeing the very first ones when they started making a comeback. They were gone for decades. And then they started reappearing. They came in from New England, Appalachians, and down from Canada or wherever. We don't know the origin of the restocking population, but they once they got their foot in the door, they went gangbusters, and they just populated the area from the Adirondack High Peaks right into the Hudson Valley, so that they're nesting on a railroad bridge on the Hudson Valley down in the Hudson, along the Hudson River. So they have filled in all of the available habitats and continue to do so. So that's a story that's a bit of a mystery, but it's ongoing.
Do they like elevation, as Jason says?
They used to be. They used to be confined to the higher elevations in New York or the Adirondacks and up in Maine and the Appalachians and down. But and Yosemite in the West, but now they've adapted, they've moved on, they've now filled into, like I say, the river valleys.
That's very cool. I look forward to seeing more.
Oh, I love ravens. They're great birds. I have them by my house, and I live on the river, and I see them about once a week. I hear them coming.
Okay, so the crow sounds like ah ah, and the raven sounds like
ah ah.
I love when you do that. Let's go.
And then there's the other crow, the fish crow, the little guy. Yeah. Ah ah. Ah, 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 ah.
Okay, you know, I'm not going to take any more calls. We'll just have you do this for the last 8 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay, open up the windows out there and you see who comes flying in, listeners.
And quote the raven?
Quote the raven.
Ah, ah.
Right. Over to line three. Jim in, where are you calling from, Jim?
Day, D-A-Y, New York.
Okay, well, you're on.
It's on a Sacandaga Lake in the southern Adirondacks.
Sure, I know, yes.
Right out my window I have two clumps of sumac trees, and they get these big panicles of white, of red flower fruits.
Yes.
And one of them, the birds decimate them in the fall.
Yes.
There's not a berry left. And the other one, they leave. It's as if they were saving them for the bad weather. Is there any reason why they'll eat one and from one bunch of trees and not the other berries?
Well, no. I can't imagine. Now, are they the same species of sumac? We have several different varieties of sumac.
That I don't know. They look the same to me.
Yeah, there's
a red flower, the same leaf, and the same red fruit.
If they're growing side by side, I suspect they're the same species. Staghorn sumac.
Together, but they'll eat half of it and save the half.
Yeah.
Of it.
Well, it's not that they're saving it. They just it's not palatable, desirable.
They're not hungry enough, maybe.
But I don't know why they would go after what the first tree has more so than the other tree. You know, a tree
because they're growing in the same soil.
Exactly, and they should be identical in their nature. So a bit of a mystery. Check it out.
I think that Jim, if you hear of a science forum coming up on Vox Pop, call one of the biologists, and we'll see if we can get that answer.
Hey, that's a good idea.
Hey, thanks, Jim.
And you got time for one more?
Very quickly, go ahead.
Give me a whippoorwill sound.
Whippoorwill.
Yeah, that's it. Whatever happened to them? I used to have loads of them. I haven't seen them in 30 years.
You're not alone. The whippoorwill, which is a night-flying bird. It's a delightful little bird that sings through the night.
I've never seen them. I can only hear them.
Yes, exactly, because they're very cryptic. They blend in with the ground. They're out there in the dark. Difficult to see, but they disappeared throughout the area and probably has to do with the food supply. The big moths that they used to feed on, I think that's what disappeared first.
Very interesting.
Well, I live way in the woods, thousands of forever wild acres around me.
Yes.
And so many things are missing that used to be here.
Well,
like the bittern. You're familiar with the bitterns.
Yes, of course. And, you know, the whippoorwill and the nighthawk, both related. Part of the problem may be here. Part of it may be where they spend the winter. And it may be a problem with the winter food supply in South and Central America.
Interesting. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Over to Carol in Queensbury. Carol.
Hi. I have woodpeckers pecking the side of my cedar house, and I was wondering if you had any advice.
Well, it depends on why they're at the side of the house. Woodpeckers will use wood to make a resonant sound. They're drummers. They will drum against the wood to create that that loud drumming sound that other woodpeckers take notice of. And the other possibility is that they're looking for food, which is why they also, another reason why they will drum against a tree or wood siding. So if they're looking for food, then you need to, there's probably food there for them. So you need to look to see that there's not some sort of a infestation that's attracting them. And then if it's for the resonant effect, the sound effect, then, you know, there are measures that you can take, such as putting burlap up, you know, temporarily. We're not talking about lining your house with tarps, but for the time being.
No, because that would be performance art, and we don't want to see that.
No. All right. And just discouraging them, you know, find a better tree.
So how long would you leave burlap up?
I don't know. However long it takes for them to change their mind and go elsewhere.
Do they only do that during mating season?
Yes, they do. It's a territorial claim, and that's how they sing is they drum. They do the percussion part.
Oh, all right.
Well, thanks, Carol.
Well, good luck with that. It's a tough question, but and you know, especially if there's some sort of an insect infestation that they're after, you don't want to know that.
Yeah.
You want to know it, but you don't want to have to deal with it.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay, and I guess we have time for one or two more here. Let's go to Lou in Albany. Lou.
Yes, just briefly, I wanted to know about the health of the birds of prey, the hawks, the falcons, eagles, and my favorite, the owls. Are they thriving? Are they making a good comeback? I've seen some red tails over Washington Park where I live, and I've seen some peregrine falcons.
To answer your question, they're all doing very, very well. Ever since the ban on the hardcore pesticides and general cleaning up of the environment, all our raptor species are doing quite well. I think, except the American kestrel, which is our smallest falcon, but the peregrine falcon, the red-tailed hawk, the bald eagle, these guys are doing fine.
Why is the kestrel not doing well?
Don't know. It's really hard to say. Wish I knew. They used to be far more common than they are now.
Yeah.
We could go Christmas bird counts and not see any, where we used to get double digits in the past. Yeah,
but that's not all that uncommon. Birds will go for decades and come back.
This is long-term. This is a long-term decline.
How long-term?
Decades. Several decades ago, you know, I'd be studying kestrels. I'd be out there seeing, you know, logging in dozens.
Yeah. Oh.
Well, not quite dozens, but lots and lots.
Well, Rich Guthrie, thanks again for being here. Your email address once again?
RichardPGuthrie@gmail.com. If you want to know about Cuba or the Great Backyard Bird Count, which is coming up in February, Cornell site, ebird.org.
Okay.
Go for it.
Thanks, Rich. We appreciate you being here. Support comes from the New York State Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, serving the public for over 30 years, nysba.org/lawyer-referral. Apex Solar Power, Queensbury, New York, locally owned, installing solar panels, solar hot water, solar pool heating, apexsolarpower.com for information. At John Lee Auctions, winter auction this Sunday at the Desmond Hotel featuring Russian and German militaria and coins at 10:30. Fine silver, Asian antiques, and art at 12, johnleeauctions.com. Thanks again for listening to Vox Pop. Thanks for calling. And thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Deb Malik answered the phones. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Food Friday, and we'll meet the chef. Stay tuned now for a news update.